Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There is a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Michael Tortoran, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me, Mark.
Michael Tortoran is a native Angelito practicing landscape design at Zanja Madre Studios in Los Angeles, California. He has worked in small, mid-size, and global landscape architecture firms and designed projects from the smallest residential gardens to complex international podium projects. Michael's interest in discovering and sharing stories of landscape architecture led him to launch the Landscape Architecture Podcast, and since its inception, he has produced over 60 interviews with luminaries in the profession. His latest endeavor is producing a documentary series about Kat Superfisky and her work with the Los Angeles River. You can learn more about that at superfiskyfilm.com. Michael, this is an interesting conversation. Landscape architect, doing film, podcasting. I want to dive into all of that. I want to learn why you're doing it, how you're doing it. But before we do that, I want to know more about you. I want you to go back to wherever you want to go back to. Where did you discover your passion for what you do today and share that story to where you are today?
Sure. So I grew up in Los Angeles. And first off, I'm pretty jealous of your voice. Being a podcaster, I think you hit the lottery with that.
Thank you.
I wish maybe you could do all my voiceovers for me. But anyway, yeah, so I grew up in Los Angeles, California, and I was an artist, but I didn't have a lot of direction. So in order to thwart that, I joined the Coast Guard. I did 4 years of heavy weather search and rescue.
Thank you for that service.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. After that, I used my GI Bill to get an art degree because I've always identified as an artist. And so I was very fortunate to align myself with a very good art school. That was, I learned photography, printmaking, drawing, all of that. And I was fortunate to be a professional artist for about 10 years. And after about 10 years, there was like a fork in the road, and it was like, okay, do I want to be a professional artist for the rest of my life, or do I want to find something different? And I decided that I wanted something with more, of a sense of civil responsibility. So like many, I think all architects secretly want to be artists, and I think all artists secretly want to be architects.
Yeah.
So I decided to become an architect, and I started going to lectures at UNLV in their library. They had a great lecture series, and in that lecture series, a landscape architect spoke. And from that moment on, I knew exactly what I wanted to be. I was like, okay, I want to be a landscape architect. Because like many people, you know, the general people don't know about landscape architects. It is changing. And there is more exposure.
Yeah.
But definitely 15 years ago, it was a lot less.
What was it, Michael, about that lecture that resonated with you that sort of changed everything for you?
Sure. What it was there was a landscape architecture firm, and I wish I can't remember the name because it was so long ago and I didn't know what I was looking at the time. But if I was to try to, articulate what it was that attracted me to the field, was they were the lead on a project in China in which there was a series of dwellings that were 70% subsurface, 30% above ground. And then of course there was like really elegant roof gardens that swayed over them. And, you know, he talked about how siting was important. And of course the production value of the green roofs in regards to producing actual fruit. Subsistence, right? And also the aesthetics. And the images were so beautiful. And I was like, okay, that's what I want.
Something in your background that sort of, when you saw that and realized that was possible, that there were people who designed those kind of things that helped you connect to that? Or was it just, it just popped up and like, wow, that's something new and you were interested in it?
I come from a long line of farmers. And I was born, I've never farmed a day in my life. But if you believe that there is things that carry over, with like epigenetics or that kind of stuff. Sure, and if you subscribe to that ideology, I feel like there was a strong pull towards regaining back.
And probably stories you probably heard as a child of your family and what they did. And that makes sense. Yeah.
And visiting, I visited Serbia, 5-6 times as a kid, and we'd play on the farm and stuff. Of course, we were the Westerners that were visiting. We didn't have to do any work, but I guess even just playing in the cornfields and jumping in the haystacks and the silos and riding the tractors and smelling the diesel was all pretty cool experience.
Yeah, so it was all part of you inside somewhere. And so when you saw that lecture, it sort of connected with a piece of who you were.
I suppose. And then if I get to draw as well, right, and put my art career, apply my art career to something that, and it worked. And then I just started studying for my GRE, and I never looked back. It was one of those definitive moments where I was like, oh, this is it. I know what I'm doing.
So you became a landscape architect, and where did that take you?
Sure. So I graduated from Ohio State in 2000. When did I graduate? 2012. I am a practicing landscape architect, but I don't have my license yet. Yep. So I'm a landscape designer, but I'm sure you architects understand that it gets really complicated. So professionally,
you're trained as a landscape architect. Yeah.
So professionally, I have to declare that I'm a landscape designer for liability, but
sure.
So what was the question?
Well, how did becoming a landscape architect or being trained as a landscape architect lead to where you are now?
Sure. So I've always had a really strong entrepreneurial spirit in whatever it is that I did. And when I got out of school, I started taking on a couple residential jobs, and then I realized I have no idea what I'm doing. It's way more complex than I would have thought. So I worked for a design build firm, which is, I think, one of the best things that I've ever done, because you get to design a construction detail and that day it's being built, right? Or you get to see your work live in process. You get to see your mistakes. You get to see the contractor's mistakes. So, and I think I like to think like an engineer, and that really excites me. I love, like, if I'm at a party, I might corner you and talk to you about bolt sizes and threads for 4 hours, right? Until you like either walk away or you're just as passionate as I am. So I really love that aspect where I got to really dive into the construction detail parts of it. I outgrew that firm a little bit, and from there I went to SWA, which is an international firm. And I got to do big projects in Los Angeles, Serbia, Dubai, lots of work in China.
And that's, you're doing landscape architecture at that point?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, all landscape architecture. And I specialize in planting plans and I was like the construction detail guy, right? Like if you couldn't figure it out, you'd come to me and I would do my best to try to propose certain answers. And then from there, I left and I went to Rios, formerly known as Rios Clemente Hale Studios, now just Rios. And I was in the residential department there. So I kind of came back full circle, but really high-end residential, where some of the projects just for the landscape is a larger budget than a lot of public parks, which was a crazy existential experience.
Yeah. Is that mostly due to the scope of the projects or the types
scope,
of plants?
Scope, size, okay. Clients, all of the above.
So you're talking about features. Full landscape transformation, full-size, full-grown trees, transplantation and all that.
Yeah, not just plants. Like when you talk about landscape architecture, it's all about, there's also hardscape and pools and, circulation and water feature consultants with water fountains that rival, the same people who are doing the Bellagio water fountains, those types of consultants. And so that was a lot of fun. And then I just decided to go on my own. Was like, okay, now it's time. Now I actually know something, right? I can actually contribute. Yeah.
When was that when you started your own thing?
When was that? Not too long ago, maybe less than 2 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. And doing residential work?
Yeah, just residential. I like residential a lot. And of course, since I'm not licensed, it makes it a little bit more complicated to bring on an extra somebody that's licensed to get different commercial work, which I've done, and it's fine and it's fun, but for now I'm happy doing residential, and later on I'll get into public works.
So what inspired you to pursue the podcast and the video work that you're doing? What's the origin of that?
Yeah, so for the podcast, I remember being in grad school, and podcasts were pretty big at the time, not as big as they are now. But it was a thing, right? People did listen to podcasts in 2009. It was, I would say, in the common vernacular, right? And I couldn't find a landscape architecture podcast. And I remember telling my friend, it was like 3-4 in the morning, at a late night studio session. And I was like, I'm going to start a podcast when I get out. And I forgot that I did that. And then fast forward to 2015, when I started mine, my friend reached out and he's like, hey, remember you saying that you were going to? And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I did. And I did. So basically it was because there wasn't one that I started one. If there was one that I knew about that was good, I probably wouldn't have started one.
And so on the podcast, you interview other landscape architects and talk about.
We interview. I mean, it's called the Landscape Architecture Podcast. But we like to interview architects as well. People, sister disciplines. The environmentalist. So we don't narrow it just to landscape architects or super accomplished people as well. Like we do have that, but we also like to hear what first year students have to say. I think that could be just as fascinating as somebody who's been practicing for 30 years, right? Sometimes the people who've been practicing really long and are well polished, they almost have a script, right? Because they've given 7 lectures this year, right? And so by the time they get to you, it's
automatic.
It's a little automatic, which is fine, right? And as a facilitator, you know this, it's your job to kind of extract, to go a little bit beyond that. But
So with the podcast, what's the audience? Is the profession, or do you reach, or who's the intended audience of that show?
Sure. The intended audience is landscape architects, landscape designers.
Yeah.
And at now, but what we're getting much more political. We're having panel discussions. We're tackling bigger issues. As I become a better facilitator, I'm able to take on more complex challenges in an interview. And so we want to hit a little bit harder. And when we have done that, our audience has expanded more outside of our field because there's greater interest. And we've done 6 episodes in Spanish so far, which is really great.
Yeah.
And you know, next we want to get into Mandarin, and we want to get into French, and we're really trying to expand a lot.
That's great. And so you're doing podcasts, you're sharing the story of landscape architecture and the profession through that podcast. But the way I connected with you is through your documentary video series, Super Fisky.
Yes.
Talk about, how did that start? Where did that come from? Well, actually, before we do that, what is it? And then let's talk about where.
Sure. So Super Fisky is a series. There's a little bit of confusion in regards to this series. It's not a series about her continually. So part 2 is not going to be Kat Super Fisky again in a different light. It's going to be a different landscape architect. And a lot of people have that confusion because I don't think I conveyed it well. But so back to Kat Super Fisky. She is a woman from Michigan, and she moved to LA, Los Angeles, just to focus on working on the LA River through the eyes of an urban ecologist and a landscape architect. Now, I have been a professional photographer in parallel to my landscape design career.
Yeah, I've seen that. Your photos are beautiful. I checked them out on your website. Really well done. Yep.
Thank you very much. I like to shoot for architects and landscape architects. So if you think about it, here I am, a landscape architect. I'm a photographer and I'm a podcaster, right? So I'm telling stories through narration. I'm telling stories through video, and I'm telling stories through design. So it's a very natural progression to just create a movie and combine all 3 of them. And one thing that I think your audience might find interesting is the catalyst for me actually doing that documentary is Rem Koolhaas's son, Tomas Koolhaas, created a documentary called Rem. Right. And it's all about Rem Koolhaas and his work. And I interviewed him for my podcast to talk about the filmmaking progress, or to talk about the filmmaking process, just because I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
Somewhere I knew there was deep down where I wanted to make a film, but it was just more of, I guess, a fantasy. Right. But once I interviewed him, I was so amazed by his articulation and his enthusiasm and his methodology to creating a documentary that I left that interview so inspired. And I was like, oh, I'm doing this. I'm going to create a documentary. And I didn't know how, I didn't know what, but at that moment.
You didn't even know at that point what it would be about. You just knew that this was something you wanted to do. All these pieces of who you were coming together and he inspired you to make it a thing.
Yeah. And I would say it's one of my favorite episodes that I've ever done. Not to plug my podcast, but if you're interested in all about filmmaking or just hearing Rem's Cool House's son talk about filmmaking, I highly recommend
that. Yeah, we will link that episode to our show notes. So if anybody wants to listen, just go to the show notes for this episode and you can click
the link. He's really intense. And so when I chose the intro music for that, I put like death speed metal for the intro. And afterwards, I don't think he was very happy about it. But a couple years later, I re-listened to it and I was like, no, I think that was artistically
it's appropriate.
Appropriate. So I took a little bit of creative liberty with that. But
so that inspired you to pursue documentary filmmaking. So how did you actually do it? Because what you're doing is not a YouTube video. What you were doing is real documentary filmmaking. I've seen the trailer. I haven't seen, I don't know if the actual documentary has been released, but the trailer's very high quality, very well done. Yeah. I'm looking forward to watching the documentary.
Thank you. So that's one thing. The way it came to fruition is actually a pretty cool story. So I teach at Cal Poly Pomona, not as if I don't have a shortage of things to keep my day busy, but I also lecture at Cal Poly Pomona in the landscape architecture department. And I had taught two photography classes so far. And remember in the back of my head, there was that itch to create a film. And I got a email from the department head just out of the blue. And he says, hey, do you want to teach a film class? And I was like, absolutely. I was like, now I have a crew. I have 15. I have 15 students. And I had no idea what the subject was going to be. I had no idea. I mean, I don't even know how to make a film, right? Like, so, but I have that Eastern European work ethic, can-do attitude. And I think architects and landscape architects, just by our nature of what we do, we have to understand really complex systems all the time and new ones, and we have to be able to digest it quickly. Right. So I think that skill set is something that we could take into whatever it is that we do. So I said, okay, yeah, sure, I'll teach this filmmaking class. And at first it was just going to be a series of interviews of interesting landscape architects. And I was just going to teach students how to do lighting, and I was going to make a little documentary on a collection of interviews. Yeah. And then I met Kat Superfisky.
Yeah.
And I was like, stop. This was already like 4 weeks into the class. And I said, stop. We are focusing our whole entire documentary on her. And the class was like, what are you talking about? We can't just shift. And I was like, we can, and we will, and we are. And if you watch the trailer, you'll understand why I made that artistic decision, because it doesn't take long to fall in love with her and the work that she's doing. So I said, okay, we're doing the whole entire interview about her. The whole entire documentary about her. And we went and I got all the equipment. I had a Sony A7 II. Four other students had Sony A7s, so we had some consistency. I had some GoPros. I had bought a drone. And here's the best part about my favorite part about making this movie is towards the end of the class, luckily we got most of our filming done, and then the pandemic hit and the school shut down, and now we can't no longer meet in person, right? And I'm a very thick-headed artist. So if I have something in my head, like a vision, and I want it accomplished, I'm going to make it happen. And one shot that I thought was important to tell the story of the LA River and the work that Kat Superfisky is doing on the LA River is we need a helicopter shot from the start of the river all the way to Long Beach, which is a 51-mile shot, which is impossible to get with the drone. You just can't do it. And so we need a helicopter. So pre-COVID, I was going to raise money. and hire a helicopter and go up and fly and film it. But when COVID hit, two things happened. One, this was when we didn't know if anyone was going to have a job, right? There was a lot of insecurity.
Right.
And I didn't feel comfortable asking my peers and my audience for money at that time because I thought it would be insensitive, right? People are
right.
worried about their jobs. And then another thing was, that was the main reason why I didn't want to do that. And I didn't have the resources to bankroll it myself, and neither did the school. So I saw this guy creating these wonderful YouTube videos post COVID of flying around LA and showing that how empty it is. And it was very, very eerie, right?
Yeah.
And so I direct messaged him on Instagram. I told him my story and I said, you know, would you help me get footage of the LA River? And I thought, okay, you know, it's worth a shot, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
He messaged me back and he says, sure. And I was like, okay, cool. Excited, but a little skeptical. 2 weeks later, he sends me 4K footage on a gimbal, which is a video stabilizer, from the belly of his helicopter, and another 4K footage on the nose of his helicopter. And he flew all 51 miles of the LA River in 4K and then just gave it to us, no questions asked.
Wow. The shot and that would, how much would that have cost in a full feature film? It probably 50 grand to do something like that?
A lot. Yeah. And so we got really lucky with that.
Let's take a break to thank our sponsors for their support of this episode. What if you could visualize your building in a couple of clicks? Remove months from the design process, or create a bridge between stakeholders to solve problems before they even come up. Our friends at Twinmotion offer simple real-time visualization for architects. Their technology lets you view and edit your scene on the go in the same pixel-perfect quality as the final rendering. Twinmotion seamlessly integrates with other tools like SketchUp and Revit, transforming your BIM or CAD models into high-quality images, panoramas, VR videos, or presentations. Sound complicated? Well, what if I told you that Twinmotion enables anyone to present the biggest ideas in the easiest way possible, regardless of previous CG experience? To download your exclusive free trial, head to twinmotion.link/entrearchitect. That's twinmotion.link/entrearchitect. BIM can be important for your next project, but it's not the only thing you need for your next project. That's why it's important that 95% of manufacturers who offer free BIM files on RCAT also offer another type of data or information that your project may need. That means 95% of the products with BIM also have CAD files, are in a specification, in a patented spec wizard, or may have product information to help you make the right selection. So stop going to a site with just BIM and go to RCAT.com to get everything you need for your next project for free and without registering. No cost, no credit card, no email, it's free. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com. When building a business you're passionate about, it's easy to feel like there aren't enough hours in the day. And if you're doing all the invoicing and accounting on your own, you're probably spending time on work you don't love. FreshBooks is built for business owners like us. It's the all-in-one accounting software that saves entrepreneurs and freelancers up to 11 hours a week. That's 11 hours that you could spend nailing a client pitch, designing your next project, or building your business as an architect. From preparing, sending, and following up on invoices, to tracking and managing expenses, to processing online payments, FreshBooks automates and simplifies all the tough and annoying parts of running your own business. So try FreshBooks for free for 30 days. No credit card required. Go to entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks and enter EntreeArchitect in the How Did You Hear About Us section and get more time back to build the business you love. That's entrearchitect.com/FreshBooks. Monograph is building a community of like-minded firm owners and operations leaders who are looking for solutions that align with their firm's values. On top of that, Monograph is building the only cloud-based practice operations software built exclusively for architects by architects. Monograph's easy-to-use and beautifully designed software allows you and your team to know in near real time whether you're on pace to deliver a project on budget. With Monograph, you and your team can plan project schedules, budgets, role assignments, and manage team members all in one place. The best part of Monograph? It doesn't require a degree in finance to use it. To experience the difference today, sign up for a free trial at monograph.com. And to underscore their commitment, on August 12th, Monograph will be hosting their first ever virtual conference. It's called Section Cut. This one-day event brings firm owners, operations leaders, and project leaders together to learn from success stories and workshops, all with the goal of improving their businesses. Reserve a seat at Section Cut today by visiting sectioncut.com. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community.
What that did was, one, it satisfied my artistic itch to get that shot. And then two, it really legitimizes our film, right? And then combine that with the great interviews and the great look and the editing. We are not a student film that's going to be on YouTube and your mom and my cousin are going to watch.
Right.
It's a real documentary.
Right. This is something you submit to film awards. And
We've already have an Excel sheet with Sundance. We have which category we will be in. We're going to submit it to the full feature documentary. And even though it is a series, this is going to be treated independent amongst itself. So that is the goal, to make sure that it's independently full circle. And we're going to hire, we already have a music composer that we like, and he's going to be about $10,000 to do that. So I'm trying to raise money to pay for that. And the way that I'm raising money is to do pre-order sales for the documentary. The idea is you watch the trailer, you fall in love with it like many people do, and you say, okay, this is something that I could support, right?
Right.
And then we have movie posters that are limited edition done by an artist and all of that. And so the stage that we're at now, so I'm editing it to be a full feature. We're getting a couple more B-roll footage that we miss. And then of course, then we're trying to finance. Because if you do a beautifully shot movie and you score the music wrong, you've ruined it.
Yeah, for sure.
And people don't even realize how important that is. And so when I start talking with filmmakers, okay, so if you're going to be a filmmaker, I have two pieces of advice for you. One, I can't say that I'm a filmmaker. I am making a film, but there's so many more people more advanced than I am. But I will tell you what I've learned so far is, one, the biggest mistake that people make when doing their first independent film or documentary is bad audio, right? And Mark, you know this. People will tolerate bad video, but nobody will tolerate bad audio.
Right. It becomes irritating. You can't listen to it.
Right. And here's another thing that's interesting about it is you don't even know why you turn it off. Yeah. Most people. It's just something I don't feel comfortable. I just turn it off. Maybe a few people, audiophiles or musicians will be like, oh, this audio is horrible. But most people will just turn it off. And so that's where I was really lucky with the 5 years or however long I've been podcasting, is I already knew how to, I know how to do a lavalier. I knew how to correct the, I knew how to trap it, and I knew how to edit it in post. And that's where people have spent $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 on an independent film, and it won't get picked up and nobody will buy it because they say you ruined your audio and they can't go back and retrap it. So that's the one good thing that I had about it. Another thing as a photographer, I understood light. I understood magic hour. I understood contrast.
And you can even see that in the trailer, that you understand what you're doing.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks. I'm glad it comes off that way. But still, you know, I'm very insecure. I'm not insecure when I talk to most people, but if I run into a established filmmaker, like I'm just like, oh, don't, please don't, you know, I don't want to hear your suggestions. I mean, I do, but
yeah,
it's like, you know, I'm pretending to be somebody. So yeah. I have to get over that.
And just, we all start somewhere, right? Even the greatest started somewhere, right? And some of them started very young, but in order to get to, you know, to be the greatest in the world, they started somewhere. And, and I say that all the time. The only way you can become good at something is to start. You're not good when you start. What I before we wrap up, Michael, I wanted to understand a little bit more about Cat Superfisky and the LA River. What is, and without giving away the whole story, what's the story about? Why is Cat important? Why is the LA River important?
Sure. Well, as we all know, Frank Gehry, won the bid for the master redesign of the LA River, which was met with a lot of contention amongst landscape architects. They chose him because of his name, which is unfortunate, because landscape architects have been, this is our jam, right? This is what we do. But that's okay. He seems to be sensitive to that fact. And he's brought on a lot of really good consultants that are landscape architects that have done tons of river restorations and all of that. And then, of course, the reason why this is important now is there's a big effort to revitalize parks and connecting tissue throughout Los Angeles via the river. So there's going to be a lot of work for architects and landscape architects to build, obviously make money, to talk about social issues and connectivity issues, creative ways of thwarting gentrification when you build along a river like this, right? It's going to increase property values. What's that's going to do? And our timing couldn't be better for this documentary, because the master plan for the LA River just got released. And so there's going to be tons of requests for proposals, requests for qualifications. So our timing is perfect. And Kat has been doing, the reason why she's so important is because she has been an advocate and doing the work prior to all of this attention and all of this funding. And so it comes from a place of authenticity,
right,
and actual work and not just theory, right? So one of my favorite stories about Kat is that, she's trying to restore a portion of the LA River across from Lewis McAdams Park. And in order to do that with native plants, the amount of native California native plants in order to do that, nurseries just couldn't fill. So what she did was, she's like, okay, well then I'm gonna grow my own. So she went through LA, foraged her own seeds, propagated them, developed a relationship with an abandoned nursery at Griffith Park, and now it's like this flourishing nursery of California natives, right? Yeah. And so you combine that with her aesthetic, you combine that with her work, with her passion, with the interest of the LA River now, and of course the soon to be explosion of more interest, right? Because of all the requests for proposals that are going to be popping up, we couldn't be, everything's so serendipitous, from the helicopter footage to the timing in my career to meeting Kat to where the LA River is going. It all seems to be falling into place.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a reason for that. Things happen for a reason, right? And you being in the position you are, and Kat being in the position she is, and the things happening at the LA River at that moment, in my opinion, is not a coincidence. Those things happen for a reason. So it's exciting to see that, to hear what you're telling us. I'm looking forward to seeing the documentary. The only thing I know about the LA River, I'm a New Jersey guy, so
yeah,
you know, I've never even been to LA. But I know the LA River through Hollywood, right? The only thing that I know about the Hollywood River is that it's concrete.
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that most of the river? Is that?
Yeah, if I could tell a little bit of that story as well, it's fascinating. So before I get into that, keep in mind that Kat thinks that the protagonist to this documentary is the river. And as I'm the filmmaker and I'm like, you're the protagonist, right? She knows she's the protagonist, but she sees the LA River as the protagonist, right?
Yeah.
And I see it otherwise, which is fantastic because that collaboration, it's going to tell the complete story.
Right. And both are true, right?
Because both are true, right? Yeah.
Your story is your story that you're trying to tell, and her story is her story that she's trying to tell. And so they are both equally, you know, accurate.
Sure. And if we did a documentary just on the LA River by itself,
right,
it would be successful and it would be fascinating. But I always like the human element to things.
Right. Yep.
And I think it just adds a little bit more dynamic to it. But real quick, the history of the LA River is absolutely fascinating. So prior to the LA River being channelized, it was a river, right? Like a real river, right? A lot of people don't believe that it was actually like a river, right? And so
it didn't grow out of the ground with concrete.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So prior to it being channelized, it was a hub for irrigation. People also don't know that Los Angeles produced this huge strawberry fields and there was a big agricultural community there. Oranges, in Los Angeles. And there was these offshoots of irrigation called zanjas, and I named my business off of that, Zanja Madre.
Oh, interesting. Yep.
Right? So mother ditch, that's what Zanja Madre means, and that's what my design company means. And I had that name before I was doing the documentary, so it was even more serendipitous, right? So anyway, so it provided irrigation, but of course it would flood every couple dozen years it would flood. And the last flood that it had, people build so close to the river that a lot of people died. And when this happened was during the Great Depression, and the LA River was actually part of the revitalization of the United States to build infrastructure.
Yeah.
And that was the money that was poured, I use that with the pun intended of concrete, was poured into creating this infrastructural project. And it was also at that time as a way to show off what concrete can do. I mean, concrete was around,
right?
But I don't know if anything was as long as 51 miles and doing a whole entire river. So it provided work, which people were happy to take. It provided a PR campaign for concrete, and then it also stopped the flooding problem, right? But now we're re-looking at it and talking with the Army Corps of Engineers and like, maybe we didn't have to calcify the whole entire river.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so now we're deconstructing that. And then there's different parts of the river. Like one part that I find that is so fascinating, that there's trees and plants and birds, and because the grade soil was so wet that they could never figure out how to calcify it with concrete. So they just left a huge portion of it raw earth. And then in different portions where they could, it's concrete. And so there's different typologies in the LA River. Of course, it's a corridor for wildlife. And now we're trying to make it as a corridor for humans by, I think there's about 26 miles that you could bike. And then we're going to try to be able to bike the whole entire thing. So imagine a 51 mile straight path in Los Angeles, which you don't get. I'm an avid bicycle rider, and like that would be heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, especially some sort of transportation other than cars. To have that yes. sort of length of transportation would be really, really amazing. That's a very interesting story. You had mentioned earlier that it's going to be a documentary series, and that the next future episodes of the series, or the next documentaries of the series, will not focus only on Cat. Will they focus on the river? Will the series be about the river?
No, it won't. So it will be on a different landscape architect and what that story is.
So similar structure that you have with Cat, you'll pick up with another document, with another designer and another story, and that'll be the theory.
And there's no shortage of amazing landscape architects that are doing really big things. However, I will say that I've almost completely voided out of my mind thinking about that, because I want my full attention into making this piece so standalone and so beautiful and possibly award-winning at Sundance or any other film festival. And my goal is one, of course, artistic expression. But another one of my goals is, when I package this, it'll be a pilot that I could pitch to Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, Showtime, HBO, et cetera.
And I can definitely see that happening.
Yeah. And if I do it right and pull it off, then it could be picked up. And that would be the kind of advocacy and exposure work that we as landscape architects could really highlight and propel and help people understand how dynamic our work can be.
Do you imagine that that becomes your full-time thing? Is that your plan, is to try to make this into a, this is what you do? You're a documentary filmmaker about landscape architecture?
No. I like to do a lot of things.
You want to do it all?
I don't know. I like the punishment of being spread, of being spread thin. However, I will say that if it gets picked up and, I sign a contract for, let's say, like 10 episodes and there's a budget, obviously I would stop everything else and I would take care of that.
Yeah. And that becomes a season in your life, and you do that, and then you.
Sure. And we would see where it goes. You know, right, if you guys exactly. are curious to where my mind is about that, I would say, think Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, add a little bit of, David Letterman's Needs No Introduction.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit of Seinfeld's Riding in Cars with Comedians. Mm-hmm. And then of course me adding my own flavor and perspective. And the beauty of this is that if I do it right, it should appeal. And that's why we didn't call it the landscape architecture documentary, right? We called it Super Fisky. So anybody scrolling through might be like, what's this about? Watch the trailer and be like, I'll watch that.
Right, right. Very well done. Super exciting to hear your story, inspiring to hear your story up to this point. I'm super excited to watch the film and to see where it goes and to watch you move forward on the rest of the documentaries that you have planned for the future. How can listeners connect with you and contribute? You said that you're raising funds to finish things up. How do people do that? Where do they go to help?
Yeah, well, if you go to superfiskyfilm.com, not frisky, no R, so superfiskyfilm.com, which is her real last name. It was a longer name in Polish, and it got shortened when her ancestors came to the U.S., which is another great story in itself. So superfiskyfilm.com, and the best way and the easiest way to support the film, of course we have a GoFundMe and we have all of that, but the best and cheapest way is just pre-order it. I think I have it on sale right now for like under $6. And if everyone pre-orders it, you get a link to an extended version of the trailer. And if enough people do that, then, I mean, I'm going to make it happen either way. It's just how easy is it going to happen, and how much of it I'm going to have to put out of my pocket.
Yeah.
And the more people that contribute, then the faster I could get this beautiful story told. So yeah, if people pre-order it, that would be fantastic. And of course, you know, anybody in media or anyone who wants to interview me or tell this story, of course, that would help as well.
All right. So if you want to learn more, you want to help share the message, you want to contribute, you want to pre-order, superfiskefilm.com is where you want to go. We will have that link in the show notes. I'm going to go pre-order because I want to see it.
Thanks, Mark.
So I'm going to do that as soon as we finish wrapping up here. Superfiskefilm.com. Before we wrap up, Michael, I wanted to ask you, what's one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Networking. I know that it's an old story, but I found that the relationships that you have are really important. Nurturing them, doing things ethically, smart, you know, not only should you be building your network, but you need to be building other people's network. After you've been in the industry for a while, you need to start mentoring people. You need to be doing things without anticipation of things coming in return. And they do, right? It's just that can't be your motivation, right? So at the same time, you're building networks, you have to support other people. And anyone who has a small business knows the value of word of mouth. And, you know, like if somebody trusts somebody and they say, I want this guy to design my landscape, it's, you're in, right? Like, unless they don't like your style or whatever, but you've been pre-vetted, right? And I think that building those relationships is good. And I learned that fairly young, but I appreciate it more and more every day, every relationship, every time someone texts me, hey, are you taking on jobs right now? Yes. You know, so I would say networking.
The building the network and building those relationships are so important. Some of the most successful architects that I've spoken with on this podcast gave the same advice, that to build your network and build real lasting relationships. That's not just about connecting with people. It's about building relationships with people. So they know who you are, you know who they are. Super valuable.
I have a short follow-up to that.
Yeah.
And is don't underestimate the power of a written thank you card. I have been writing thank you cards by hand for the last 20, 25 years. And I'll run into people at a convention and that's the first thing they bring up is they say, oh, thank you for that handwritten card that you
they remember
mailed, right? And you know, 35 years ago, probably most people didn't write thank you cards, but if they did say thank you, it was with the card or something, right? Now it's like email or a text or something. But to do one now in 2021, to receive something tangible with, and you know, I tell that to my students when they go to apply for jobs, I say, write a thank you card and mail it to the person that interviewed you, you know? And that's a very easy and inexpensive way, an authentic way to really separate yourself apart. That being said, I'll probably get your address and ask, I'll mail you a thank you card. So, to say how grateful I am for you being interested in my story.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I think it's a great way, especially now. It's a great way to stand out because everybody knows the mail is a bunch of junk now, right? All our bills aren't even coming through mail anymore. So even the important stuff's not coming through mail. It's just a bunch of junk. And so when you get something that's really meaningful, first of all, it makes you happy. It gives you an emotional connection to that person who wrote that, but it stands out, right? Those people remembered that you did that because it's so different than everything else that's happening in their lives at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the micro, or that's something. So the big concept is networking, and then an actual tangible
tactic
could be writing a thank you card.
Yeah. His name is Michael Todoran. Todoran.
Todoran.
Oh, I have it misspelled here.
That's okay.
I can edit that.
That's fine.
His name is Michael Todoran. The website is superfiskyfilm.com. We're going to have links to all of that on the show notes. Michael, thank you for doing what you're doing, to sharing the story of Cat Superfisky, for sharing the story of landscape architecture and what landscape architects do. And thank you for joining me here today. This has been a lot of fun today at Entree Architect Podcast.
The pleasure was all mine, Mark. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
If you liked this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Links to all the resources we discussed today are available at the show notes for this episode found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. And thank you to RCAT, Studio Services Bookkeeping, FreshBooks, and Twinmotion for their support of this podcast. Entree Architect is proud to be a partner with the largest, most engaged AEC multimedia network on the planet, Gable Media. We're curating thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com. That's GableMedia.com. And check out Entree Architect Academy membership, ready to edit business resources, live monthly training for architects, business training that is, a supportive architect community, yep, it's there, and Simple Systems, our new business system program developed for small firm entrepreneur architects just like you. It's in there for you at Entree Architect Academy. It's waiting for you right there at the membership. Come join me and hundreds of your entrepreneur architect friends. Visit entrearchitect.com/join to enroll today. Be well, my friends. Be healthy, happy, safe, and secure. Thank you for listening today. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark Arlepage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short haul, frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.